In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear Luis Rodriguez speaking to an overflowing house about his life and works. The talk was given at the California State University at Channel Islands on November 29th of 2005, with the new release of his book of poetry, My Nature is Hunger, and the revised edition of Always Running. We join Dr. Joan Peters as she introduces Luis Rodriguez.
He's published 10 books in just about every genre: memoir, young adult, poetry, fiction. And in 2005 alone, he published Music of the Mill, a book of poetry, and a book of poetry, My Nature is Hunger, New and Selected Poems, 1989 to 2004. Perhaps his most famous work, the one many of our students have read, is his 1993 groundbreaking memoir, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. He's also won numerous awards for his work, including the Unsung Heroes of Compassion Award presented by the Dalai Lama. But that's not all. Rodriguez has also started several organizations, some of which, like Youth Struggling for Survival, help kids in a way that Rodriguez himself knows would have made a difference in his life early on. He also helped start Rocamole Productions, a music and film company. And finally, he is co-founder of Tia Chucha's Café y Centro Cultural in Sylmar in the San Fernando Valley. And if you're interested in the café and maybe would like to take a visit, you can go to the website, which is tiachucha.com, to see what's doing there and what the activities are. So now, let's welcome Luis Rodriguez.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here, and I hope that we have a very alive and happening questions and answers. I love doing that probably more than anything because I love the dialogue that we have. So please think of some comments and questions. I thought what I would do to start is start with a poem. How many want to hear a poem? Good, good. Because I have a lot of things to say, and so poetry is a good way to start anything. To me, it's becoming a way for me to open up a sacred space, a place where people can be honest and open, where it's not filled with a lot of language that does not really go very deep. The problem with the culture is there's so much language out there, but most of it you can't trust anymore. You know what I'm talking about. You can't trust the politicians, unfortunately, when they say something. You can't trust even the newspapers sometimes. You can't even trust most of the languages to sell you things, advertisement, billboards, commercials. So we stop seeing language as something where we can get real meaning. And to me, that's sad. It's something that we should strive to change. And for me, poetry is one of the ways in which language gets back to condense meaning in depth, gets back to truth and honesty and openness, gets back to meaning that can't find anywhere else. So this is a poem that's called My Name's Not Rodriguez. And it's actually the name of my CD that Rocamole helped put together. And just so you know, the poem has many layers. But one of the things that people always ask me afterwards is, does that mean that they can't call me Luis Rodriguez anymore? So no, you can still call me Luis Rodriguez. It's just the poem is trying to say something about the deeper name that many of us have, especially of Mexicans who have roots in this land as deep as anybody's, who have indigenous roots, and we don't know these names. And I went back to my mother's tribal roots in Southern Chihuahua. She was Tarahumara, and her family was Tarahumara, and I went back there. And most of the Tarahumara indigenous people, including the traditional ones, don't have their names anymore, their indigenous names. I was talking to a lot of people, and I once asked this lady, what's a good Tarahumara name? And she said, oh, Rosa, Teresa, Maria. And I kept saying, no, a really good Tarahumara name. She said, Rosa, Teresa, Maria. So they don't have the real indigenous names anymore. So this is about the names that are still within us. Even if we don't remember them, they're in our bones. They're in our DNA. They're in our gene makeup. My name's not Rodriguez. It is a sigh of climbing feet, the lather of gold lust, the slave master's religion with crippled hands gripping greed's tail. My name's not Rodriguez. It's an Indian mother's noiseless cry, a warrior's saliva on arrow tip, a jaguar's claw, a woman's enticing contours on volcanic rock. My real name's the ash of memory from burnt trees. It's the three-year-old child wandering in a plane and shot by U.S. Cavalry in the Sand Creek Massacre. I'm a Geronimo's yell into the canyons of the old ones. I'm the Comanche scout, the Rada Moody shaman, and soiled bandana running in the wretched rain. I'm called Rodriguez, and my tears leave rivers of salt. I'm Rodriguez, and my skin dries on the bones. I'm Rodriguez, and a diseased laughter enters the pores. I'm Rodriguez, and my father's insanity blocks every passageway, scorching the walls of every dwelling. My name's not Rodriguez. It's a fiber in the wind. It's what oceans have immersed. It's what's graceful and sublime over the top of peaks, what grows red in desert sands. It's the crawling life, the watery breaths between ledges. It's taut drum and peyote dance. It's the brew for fermented heartaches. Don't call me Rodriguez unless you mean peon at sod carrier, unless you mean slayer of truths and deep sixer of hopes, unless you mean forget and then die. My name's a black hooded 9mm wielding child in all our alleys. I'm Death Row Monk, the 8-year-old gum seller in city bars and taco shops. I'm unlicensed, uninsured, unregulated, and unforgiven. I'm free and therefore hungry. Call me Rodriguez and bleed in shame. Call me Rodriguez and forget your own name. Call me Rodriguez and see if I whisper in your ear, mouth stained with bitter wine. Thank you. I'm glad to be back to California. I've only been back here 5 years. As some of you know, I lived in Chicago for 15 years, and I had to come back for a lot of reasons. One, because this is really home for me, and also because I still have family out here. But I'm going to tell you something that's on my mind, because it's a big issue now. I've been back, and 4 times since I've been back, I've been told 4 different occasions to go back to where I came from. And I would tell you that I've been all over the country, and as great and as beautiful as California is, because it is beautiful and it's got a lot of great people and a lot of things, it is also still one of the most anti-Mexican states anywhere. And I don't know if you're aware of it, and I don't know how much you're aware of it. I'm telling you, I've been to places, and this has got to be still a really hard place to be Mexican, particularly people from Mexico who are immigrants, newly arrived. And I think that this is kind of causing a lot of problems, that even Bush is trying to come up with a plan, and everybody's trying to think of something. One of the worst ideas that is actually right now in Congress that may actually pass, it's hard to say, is this fence they want to build. It's an $8 billion fence from California all the way to Texas. And if we build it, we will stop being a civilized people, if that's ever even been an issue, you know what I mean? I'm telling you, this has got to be one of the worst ideas I've ever heard. And people are serious, and they're going to do it, and it put $8 billion in this. And I come in L.A., where you have the largest homeless population in the whole country, where Skid Row is the largest enclave of homeless, where you have people living in cardboard boxes, and somebody wants to put an $8 billion fence to keep people out. Something is really wrong with our imagination, our spirit and our souls, but the imagination is completely being collapsed. And these are the same people, by the way, who have taken us to a war that we shouldn't be in, who have couldn't help out when Hurricane Katrina went through the Gulf states. The same people who have made these crazy policies, have abandoned certain things, have put us our jeopardy as far as, you know, our children and everything else, are the same ones coming up with these ideas. And I don't really care if they're Republicans or Democrats. To me, that's not even the main thing. That both of them have participated at some level behind this madness. And it is madness. I mean, just think about it. It is totally mad. It's like I tell people when, you know, Mexicans come, we work, a lot of things happen. People raise families. They bring a lot of values. People from Mexico come with a lot of values. They have a lot of beautiful things to offer. And people are going crazy. They're losing their minds. You hear what I'm saying? They're losing their minds. They can't even think straight. I was told that this used to be, the campus used to be a mental institution. I'm thinking, so I don't want to be disrespectful to anybody. But I think what it is, they closed down this Camarillo. What it is, they put people in Congress and they put people running the government, you know? I'm serious. I mean, people cannot stop and think straight now. So like we're losing our way, our balance. We're off balance. And people just don't know what to do. And they're so scared, they'll do the most craziest, nuttiest thing. So we have to get back to some balance and some imagination, and we have to get back to some real dialogue and to stop the clock, to slow everything down and start paying attention. We're losing so many of our kids. We're losing so many of really wonderful people that shouldn't be lost. I go to California, 165,000 prisoners. How can you have the state with the fifth or sixth largest economy? And you know what? We're number one in prison in the world. And yet, if you look at our statistics, we're like at the very bottom of schooling. Very bottom at arts. The California Arts Council is a joke. I mean, not to put down any great heroic people working for them, but that's not enough for what we need for arts, creativity, for music, for poetry, for all these things. Here in this great economy, we cannot sustain arts in our schools. And yet we can make prisons like crazy. Last time I was in jail, there was 15 prisons in the state of California. There's 35 and more. I think there's more. I think there's almost 40 prisons in the state of California. There was 15,000 prisoners. Now there's 165,000. In 30 years, this is what's happened. And if people don't think this is madness, then they talk about it. I think this is madness. I think this says something wrong about what's happening. I was on a radio show in New York City where somebody even asked me, well, what is it about the Mexicans coming over? Why did they come here? What did they contribute? What's happening, you know? And I had to bring in some statistics just so he knows what we're dealing with here. I don't know if you're aware, but Los Angeles as a city by itself has a greater GNP, gross national product, than all of Mexico. Just LA alone, more than all of Mexico. The 10 million Mexicans who are working here that are either nationals, either undocumented, or even illegal, or, you know, I'm sorry, legal, residents, 10 million or so, because nobody knows the exact number, make more money being here than the close to 100 million people that still live in Mexico. We're not talking about just one kind of country that's equal to another and let's put a block. We're talking about a very poor country, and Mexico is not the poorest country in the Americas. We're talking about another world encroaching. We're talking about, they call it the third world. But it's most of the world is like that. Most of the world is hungry. Most of the world is starving, in fact. And to me, this is hurting everybody. You cannot live in peace as long as you have that kind of world. And I'm not supporting terrorism. I hate terrorists just like everybody else. But you're not going to fight terrorism by going to war with terror. You hear what I'm saying? You can't stop terrorism with terrorism. But that's what we do. I've said this before in the streets. In LA and other communities, as you know, even in Oxnard and other communities, they try to stop gang warfare with more gang warfare. That's what it is. Just more gang warfare. Gang injunctions. More police. More prisons. It's just another gang warfare, and that's the way they want to stop gang warfare. It's not going to work. Again, you have to have an imagination. You have to have a dialogue that sustains itself. You have to have people who have never been heard be heard to speak and finally tell their stories. You have to hear the stories of these young people, these people who are trying to come over here. We see them as invisibles. We will never understand why they're here. We will never understand why we're here. And I think this is important for me because I've written so many books, and all of them have that thread of the rootlessness, rootless, like not having roots, that seems to be in my life and in the life of what I'm talking about, how we become so uprooted. And being uprooted takes a lot of sacrifice and a lot of pain because you don't even know who you are anymore. And we don't know who we are anymore. You know, and we lose a lot of very deep connections. And people don't want to leave Mexico. They don't want to leave Central America. They don't want to leave their homes. Some of those places are very beautiful. Some of those places are just amazing. Why would they do it? Because they have to. A starving people have no country, as I've said many times. Remember that. A starving people have no country. The borders don't mean anything when you can't eat. So we have to imagine a whole new world. I really believe this. And this is before we even start building one. This is before we even think we're gonna all of a sudden reconstruct something. Imagine it. If we don't use imagination, we're not going to be able to make the real changes. And if we don't make these changes, we're going to pay a bigger price in the end. 2001, with the World, you know, Trade Center's towers coming down, should have awakened us to real healing, should have told us something. And I think for a short time, there was some kind of healing happening. I don't know if you remember the kind of connection that people were starting to make. People were talking to each other, never talked to each other. people in the subways in New York City were being nice to each other. I mean, there was things that never happened for a long time. All of a sudden, people were doing it. They were starting to feel their own mortality. This big, invincible ideal that they had was crumbling, and they needed to have some consolation, some help. And for a while, it looked like there was going to be healing. But this is where, again, at those moments, when we have an opportunity to really imagine something different, to really work hard, to really heal, people fall down to their closed imagination. And the first thing they do is go to war. And all that consolation thing stopped. Now we are more divided than we ever have been as a country. And I've been around for 51 years, and this is the most division I've ever seen in this country. And we have been always divided as a country. I've never seen it this bad. You know, we're just, the whole thing is just dividing everybody. And even immigration is dividing everybody. And war is dividing everybody. And we're just totally divided. People looked at the election between Bush and Kerry, and they thought, oh, okay, Bush won. It was showed the division. It showed more than anything how divided we were. I don't know if you're aware, but Kerry had more votes than any other president candidate in the history of voting in the United States. You hear what I'm saying? He had more votes than any other candidate in the history of voting in the United States except for Bush. People went to vote, and the whole country got divided. And what is red and blue states? Another gang, as far as I'm concerned. And they got red and blue, Crips and Bloods, Norteño, Sureño, same thing. It's like all of a sudden red and blue is everybody's and now divided again, red and blue. This is what we do. We have taken the gang mentality in the streets, and we have taken it to the corridors of Congress. We have taken it to the voting booth. And people are pissed off. And you know, I think this division is really hateful and hurtful. And there's got to be a way to break it down. If we're going to move as a society and as a culture, and if we're going to be so-called country that will be a light for anybody, we can't be this unimaginative, hateful, and terribly divided country as we are. And this is what I'm trying to get at. There is a way to bring unity, and I think that that's what I would like for us to talk about. Some of your ideas, some of your issues, some of your concerns, because I do think that it's going to take a whole new way of thinking and a whole new way of acting and a whole new way of dealing with things. But one of the things that I have learned in my indigenous, trying to get my indigenous roots and trying to understand some indigenous cosmology, trying to understand something that has been forgotten in this very strange, capitalist, expedient, you know, fast-moving world that we're in, we forget some very basic truths, very basic principles. And we have to go back to them because they're very old and they've been in our bones for everybody. Everybody has these indigenous mind, as we call it. The indigenous mind. I'm going to share with you a few truths and then we ought to open it up. But one of them is the fact that, you know, the earth, just like our bodies, regenerates, as you understand that, the earth has a built-in regenerative capacity. You tear into the earth and, you know, it'll find a way to remake itself. And for us, too, you know, we cut ourselves. People don't think twice about it. You cut yourself and you see the scarring and you don't think twice about it. It's a miracle to me. I started paying attention to this. What an amazing thing we have that we can actually heal over cuts. Now, of course, if you're too deep of a cut and everything else, you can't do it. Same thing with the earth. The earth regenerates itself under certain conditions. And if we cut too deep into the earth, it cannot do it. And we have gotten to the point now as a culture that we're cutting deep into the earth. And the earth is not going to die. We'll die. The earth is too big and too powerful to die. People say the earth's going to die. We're going to die before the earth dies. The dinosaurs got that. A whole mess of animals got it. They're going to die before the earth dies. But this is why I have to, important to lay out that there are principles that have been given to us. And one of the principles is to be in balance with nature and ourselves and our relationships. To be in balance. To be in balance just means not to take more than you need. The earth is abundant. That is the very nature of earth and very nature of our being. But we live in a society of scarcity. See what I'm saying? You know what I'm talking about when it's scarcity? You know what I'm saying when, like I said, you got homeless people living in cardboard boxes? And I took my son, my 17-year-old son, Ruben, and his girlfriend to downtown Skid Row, just so as a teaching thing. We took the subway from North Hollywood, went all the way to Union Station, walked all over downtown, took him through Broadway, took him through Chinatown, took him through Vera Street, and then I took him to Skid Row. And she was a little scared. I said, don't be scared. Nobody's going to hurt you here. But I want you to see this. And there was one section, I mean, you know, you can go for blocks and you see all these cardboard boxes and tents, mostly African-American, but a large number of Mexicans and Central Americans. And we went to one, we saw it was walking out because we didn't go all that deep. I just figured we would get to the edges and they would see. And then we walking out and there was a big fence with a bunch of tents and cardboard boxes and huge skyscrapers right above it. And you can see then the contrast of the world that we've gotten. I have a friend from London who says that he's been all over the world. He's been to Calcutta and he says this is worse than Calcutta because you see these skyscrapers, this beautiful, glamorous world right next to people sleeping on the sidewalks. So this is scarcity. Scarcity says there's not enough for everybody. Scarcity says that, you know, we got only one piece of the pie and I got to get mine because somebody else is going to get it if I don't. Scarcity means we got to compete just to survive. It means you got to have people from Mexico leaving their beautiful lands, having to go across the border, thousands dying just to get over here. That's what scarcity does, and that's totally a man-made thing. Hear what I'm saying. That is a man-made thing. That's not part of nature. It's not part of spirituality. It's not part of our being. It's a totally man-made phenomenon, scarcity. And look deep into it. I'm just giving you the top of it, but look deep. It's a man-made thing. This is something we can control. This is something within our power as human beings to change. A lot of people don't want to because they make a lot of money off the competition. There's a lot of big corporations sitting out there, but even General Motors can't do it. General Motors, the number one corporation in the world, is having a hard time. Competition is hurting everybody, including the biggest corporation that exists. It hurts everybody to be in a competitive scarcity mode. This is an assumption that does not have to be. The indigenous mind always knew that if you had a proper relationship to the earth, respectfully, meaningfully, it would always get back to you. It will always get back to you. If you have a proper relationship with your neighbor, with your friends, with your community, it would always come back to you. If you have a proper relationship with whoever you believe is God, with the Creator, it would always come back to you. Those are the three principles that we've forgotten. And I want to get back to them. Because if we're going to reimagine things, we've got to at least stand on something that we know for a fact has kept human beings going all these years. And now we've reached the point in which we may not make it. And I do mention, it was brought up about in my new book, my Always Running, as you know, has been put out. How many have actually read Always Running? Okay, good. So we'll have a good talk. It's just come out again. It's a new cover. It's got a study guide now. And I wrote a whole introduction into it, a whole new introduction. And I included the situation with my son who's in prison. He's serving 28 years. I had to put it in there because I wrote the book for my son and a lot of people didn't know what happened to him. Well, he's sitting in prison serving 28 years. But one of the things I bring in there is a teaching that I learned from indigenous elders is that we have to think about things. And we have to do things now that affect not just our generation, not just the next generation. We have to think and act for seven generations from now. Do you know what a whole different way of thinking that is? Where you're trying to preserve things not just for me and my family, but for seven generations. Who thinks this way? You know what people think? I don't know who those people are, so I don't even have to worry about it, right? Who are those people seven generations from now? Well, that's the way we have to think. What we do now affects them. And the kind of actions and the kind of policies and the kind of thinking that we have has to go that deep. Seven generations at least to make sure those seven generations exist. So I want to leave you with that. A whole new way of thinking. But it's actually very old thinking. It's very old and has sustained us for a long time. And again, it goes back to the indigenous ways, what everybody has. I don't care what race, what color, you all have an indigenous mind somewhere in there. And I just want to add one last thing. Like I told you, in California, four times people told me to come back where I came from. This is how everything's turned to its head. The indigenous brown, red people are now the strangers. We're now the foreigners. We're now the illegals. See how everything got turned around now? All of a sudden, we've been in this land since before anybody. Now we're the ones that don't belong. You know, there's 2 million Mayans, who don't even speak Spanish, let alone English, in the LA area. 2 million Mayans in the LA area. They call them Hispanics because they don't know what to call these people. They're not Hispanics. They're Mayan Indian people. We don't even call them Native. So this is why everything's turning its head. We don't know what we're dealing with. We don't know who we are, and we don't know where we're going. So this is what I would like to hopefully have us talk a little bit and share a few things. And I want to open it up to you to talk to me and talk to each other. about what we think we need to do. Thank you. Thank you for listening. I know I could keep talking, but I'd rather open this up. And I also wanted to point out to you that when you go to the table, you have a few of these. This is my new online magazine that I now edit. It's called Chispas with an X. Please pick it up and try to get to it. Some teachers are using it in classrooms. It's a Chicano online magazine. It has a lot about our indigenous past history. It has interviews. It has music. It has cartoons, artwork, fiction, poetry, a whole mess of different things. And we're constantly adding to it. It's an ongoing struggle to keep it, but I just want you to know that this is something else I'm contributing. And if ever you are in Sylmar or in the San Fernando Valley, come to Tia Chucha's. If you haven't seen Tia Chucha's, you will love it. You're going to love it. It's an amazing home place. It's beautifully run by my wife, who's a very beautiful person, and she manages everything, and everything she does turns out beautiful. So it's better in her hands than my hands. But she made a wonderful place out of it, and you have to come by. It's not that far away. Just enjoy it, just to know that it's there. We need more places like that. And we built it in that part of the valley because there was literally nothing for 400,000 people in the Northeast San Fernando Valley. There was no culture centers, no bookstores, no movie houses. We built it. We made it happen. And you know, just so you know, people try to stop us. People were telling us, don't do it. What's wrong with you? You're not going to make no money. I didn't care about that. It wasn't about the money. We built it, and we think we should have them everywhere. We need places like that wherever we can. So let me open it up to you to ask me things and talk and ask me questions about Always Running or the books or anything you feel like would be interesting. And let's talk a little bit about some imagination and maybe some principles and maybe some things that we have forgotten that we need to remember. We all have to live together now, so this is the time to share about what brings us together. And there's a hand right there.
You know, I really like your idea of the imagination. My
only question is, where do you even start? You know, I know that it's taken me a long time to get over the fact that I shouldn't be angry about these people coming here, that they are coming from such deep poverty that it should be a place for them to come to. And I don't even know how could you break that down so somebody can look past it and start making changes? Because I think that's where it first needs to happen, for people to stop thinking of it that way and start thinking of it, the world as a whole, and not as countries anymore. Yeah. So how do you even do that? That's where I want to know.
Well, I think that's
a
good place to start. Start with the big thing. Because, see, we get so caught up in the little thing, we can't even think. And, you know, to me, it's one of the beautiful things that really opened me up to the idea that some of it is man-made and therefore should change. Some of it is not, is that we have now, because we've got satellites, looking at the Earth, we can see the Earth with eyes that we couldn't see before. And it's a big round sphere, right? And it's blue and green and it has these beautiful white clouds and everything. There's no borders there. And you know what? I used to think when I was going to school, there was all those political maps where you had them all lined in different colors. I thought that's the way the world was set up. I thought that's the way it broke down. But look at, you take a picture like that and say, there's no borders. This is totally man-made. And we're dying and killing each other. I mean, everything that we thought was so important, our country, our religion, everything is what we're dying for. I mean, what do you think is happening in Iraq? Religious people, spiritual people are killing each other. And then nations are more important than the world? I mean, this is where you have to start big and think about that world that, you know, that was created for us. And it doesn't have one border on it. We imagine a new world and put it on top of it, and we make that world bigger than that world that's actually the reality. We're living on illusion. So we have to start by getting the illusion and getting to the reality. And once you see the world as a world, then I think you can begin to start seeing people as differently. And I'll tell you one other example. I was working with gang kids in Chicago. My son joined a gang there. I didn't know what else to do. And I was like you, where do I start? I have to do something. I couldn't just walk the walk, I mean, talk the talk. I couldn't write Always Running. I had to walk the walk. I had to do something. So I got his homies. I just told my son, bring your kids, your homies. Some don't have fathers. Some are in the street. Bring them to my basement. Bring them. We'll talk. We'll start something. We had all these kids, gang kids, meeting in the basement. And then I hooked up with this other young activist who was working with these Mexican gang kids. I was working with primarily Puerto Rican gang kids. And we started meeting with them. And then we started getting African-American gang kids. And then we started getting white gang kids. And we started spreading. In a few years, we had 12 communities represented in this group. And we didn't have any big programming. We didn't even have any funding. We didn't have any big, huge thing. The one thing we had is we needed to rebuild a proper, respectful relationship between adults and young people, between one neighborhood to another neighborhood, just to be little by little, that respectful, meaningful relationships again. And that's what we started doing. And now the group, by the way, is continuing, and they've had their last event, they had 1,000 kids show up, and they had to throw kids, had to stop kids from coming in because there were so many. Because now they've gotten into big hip-hop, conscious, a whole mess of big things that I can't even talk about, because they've really grown, because they kept taking that, building relationship by relationship. So think big, and then think about those little things you can do that can help deal with that big, real aspect of the world, not the illusions that everybody keeps putting. So anybody's got their hand up? Okay, right here. Yeah.
I just have a question. If you could share with us the process that you take on in terms of how you've gone about writing your books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, to me, it's different for everybody, but I do think that I learned some things. And one thing is that, you know, when I was in the street, if you know from always running, I was in the street a lot. I was homeless in the street. I was on heroin. I was in and out of jails. But one thing that I remembered, and I didn't even put it in the books as much. I think I put it in where I went to libraries when I went, my dad was working at Pierce College, and I went there. But the one thing I forgot is that when I was homeless in the street of downtown LA, my sanctuary was the public library. I used to go there every day. That was where a lot of homeless people hang out. And I loved reading the books. And something about the books and the words helped me. So I think that it was, first of all, for anybody who wants to write, the first thing you got to do is be motivated from inside here. Because writing is like anything else. It's a hard, difficult thing. Nobody's going to give you anything. You have to want it so much that you'll just keep writing. You'll keep telling the stories. Now, what I done is after I left the gang life, I worked in factories, and so I learned to work like 9 to 5. So that's what I do. My writing process is I get up in the morning, and I'm working from the morning as long as I can, writing, creating. And I can't always do it all day long. I mean, I can't. I mean, I have so much work to do that I have to stop at a certain point. But I give myself at least 2 or 3 hours a day if I can. 2 or 3 hours is a great thing. And I'm writing so many different things that I'm writing poetry, I'm writing essays, I'm writing new novels. I got a screenplay I'm working on. So I got to know how to keep shifting because each one of them have different dynamics and each one of them require a knowledge of the genre to do it well. But I think that's my working process. It's just give myself like a job and work at it, and everybody sees it as a job. If you don't do that, nobody will see it that way. They always think writing is a frivolous thing that you're doing on the side. So, well, come, you don't have a job, a real job like everybody else, you know. But I think it really is important to have a job that's also your passion. You know what I'm saying? If this is what you're passionate about, that's what you should do. And whatever you're passionate about, make that your job. If you love teaching, you love kids, you should be a teacher. You know, a lot of people, as you can know, they don't realize there's art in everything. There's art in carpentry, art in mechanics, art in teaching. And you know the difference between somebody who sees teaching as an art and somebody who sees it as a job? You know what I'm talking about. I mean, for example, I've been to schools where the bell rings, the first ones out the door are the teachers. It's not to put down teachers. There's some great teachers out there, but you know what I'm saying, where it becomes a job, it's just another day, I can hardly wait to get the heck out of here. But there's teachers who love their work. They know it's hard. It tears them apart every day. They have heartbreaking moments, but guess what? They're there. They don't quit. They love the kids. That is when it becomes a passion and an art. I hope that was helpful. Anybody else?
I was just wondering where you might, if you have any recommendations for where you might find some trustworthy primary information sources for us.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of good stuff out there. I think there's a lot of people who are doing the same thing that I'm doing now, because people they do that. There's a big need now. We're at the end of something, we're at the beginning of something. You can feel it. We don't quite know what it is exactly. On the Mayan calendars, there's 2012, 2013, where they think there's gonna be a big change. There's a prophecies, Hopis have prophecies, but I just feel that, I don't know if you can actually pinpoint it, but we're in a time of endings and beginnings. This is why everybody's talking. And so there's actually a lot of books people are sharing now. Very deep books, like there's one book called Singularity by, I think his name is Richard Kurzweil, and I started to read it. It's a big, thick book. But it's amazing ideas about, very hopeful about the world that we're entering. Very hopeful in the midst of war and uncertainty and you know, calamity. All of a sudden, he's feeling hopeful that our science and our way of thinking will eventually make the world better, and good for him. But everybody's starting to go this way. Spirituality is a big thing now. Everywhere you go, people are putting out spirituality books. Some are better than others, but at least I think people are trying to put their two cents about what we need to do. And if you go to Tia Chucha's, we try to carry as many of those books as possible. There's a lot of books that I read on Mayan and Aztec and cosmology, because a lot of it is very meaningful for what we're going through now. But I don't proselytize about this. It's up to you people. I mean, what I'm saying, I definitely don't believe that anybody should go one way. You know, I think that there's many ways to go. And that's the problem I have with people who think there's one way. It's because the world is too vast and too big, and the Creator too much more imaginative than we can ever be to make us all fall into one way of doing things. There's a lot of ways to be saved, believe me. But you got to make sure you know what saves you. But there's a lot of ways to go. And I think it's important to know there's many ways to get there. So I, as far as materials and books, as I just mentioned that one because that's out there, but there's a lot of people right now trying to address these issues. Also, I work with the Mosaic Foundation out of Seattle. And the Mosaic Foundation was run by Michael Mead, who's an old Irish-American Queens guy who has one of the leading mythologists and also storytellers in the country. He's also one of the teachers at Pacifica Institute over in Santa Barbara area. He's one of these people who are thinking a lot of new ideas with a lot of old ideas mixed into it. So there are people, and by the way, Mosaic, if you go into their website, it's called mosaicvoices.org, you will get tapes and you'll get a whole mess of stuff that they're doing, including stuff that I'm doing with them. We had a beautiful reading in San Francisco with Alice Walker, Michael Mead, Jack Kornfield, and a few other well-known people. These are the kind of people who are starting to come together. They're Buddhists, they're Christians, they're African shamans, they're Native American, they're all beginning to talk now. And this, I think, is important. But again, not to take away from anybody who doesn't want anything to do with them, it's just the idea of how do we expand the conversation and how do we include more people in this conversation about where we need to go. Anybody else? Yeah.
Luis, hi, how are you? I just wanted to let you know that I did read Always Running, and having been a third generation East Los Angeles native, I gotta tell you that I really, really understood where you were coming from, having been born around many gangs. You mentioned Garrity Loma, and I grew up in that area. Of course, I chose a different route in life. I left in 1978, formed my family. But one of the most important things that I never forgot is where I came from, my culture, my race, my people, my beliefs, okay? I have never closed my mind to anything other than who I am and where I came from. I have taught my children those beliefs, and I'm very, very, very strong when it comes to my culture. I make it very clear to them that first, the Spanish language is very important for them, that they should never forget that they need to continue to speak the Spanish language. Second of all, to have a different aspect of, for example, you mentioned this immigration issue. And one of the things that this young lady was mentioning is how she's trying to come with terms on why these people come and et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of the things that I feel here is, for example, the Minutemen. We have the Minutemen out there that are trying to stop this, and they're taking, and this is where I'm gonna ask you a question, they're taking their hands, they're putting themselves as law enforcement officers, they're carrying guns, and they're putting these people, like you said, that are hungry, and they're putting their lives in danger as well. But then again, we have some of our own people, some of our own Latinos who are against this, and who are advocating against these people. You know, I know that this country cannot accommodate two or three other countries that are starving of hunger. We have so much capacity in this world. It's understandable. But it's the lack of education and the lack of knowledge that we have, not only Latinos, as the people of this country, that we don't take the time to go out there and speak for ourselves and do something about what's going on. It's always, oh, did you hear about what they're doing? And they sit there and they do nothing. They don't take the time to get up, join in an organization, speak up, or do something about these issues. I, for one, am against it, Luis. I am just angry about this whole Minuteman thing, and I feel that there was people with stronger beliefs. I am, in my own way, I'm an advocate. I'm a civil rights advocate. I am an independent civil rights advocate. And I'd want to talk to you after this whole thing is over. But I'll tell you what, if there was more people like me who would join in and say, well, we got to do something, get your butts up with all due respect and do something. Don't talk about it. Get up and say, we got to do something. This is the way how we change the world. But the most important thing we have to remember as people, not as just Mexicans or Salvadorians or Americans or Africans, we cannot forget where we come from. We are who we are. We should stand proud of it. But we are equal people. We should see each other as equal people. We are in a nation that you said is being divided, like the Great Wall of China. This is what Bush is doing. He is building the Great Wall of China. The money that he is putting into this projected project, like you said, I agree, he can be feeding homeless people. And again, it's our will, the young kids here in college. You need to make a difference. All these kids here that are here today to listen to, you need to make a difference of what this world is going to be like. You sit there and not do something about it, as Mr. Rodriguez said, the second, third, fourth, seventh generation is going to be sitting under cardboard boxes in the city of Los Angeles, in New York, in Hawaii, in Alaska, everywhere in this world. So let's not talk about it. Let's do something about it, okay?
Sounds great.
Okay.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I don't have anything to add. I think you said everything. You said it all.
Hi. I just had a question about your book. In your book, you grow a lot in your book as far as finding your identity and who you are. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me if Anglos, Hispanics, all races, if you had found out your identity and realized it, like I saw a change in you in the book as soon as you were elected as the Aztec mascot.
Yeah.
As soon as you found your roots, basically my question is, if cultures were to identify and realize their own identities, would that be a catalyst to understanding other people's cultures? But would that have helped you not get into the gang situation?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And we have a saying
if I worded that right.
No, but I think I know what you're saying. And we have a saying that goes, la cultura cura. What that really means is that the more you understand your culture, like she was mentioning, the roots, it's what happened is we're all feeling uprooted, everybody. For example, let me just throw from the other end, the idea that there's white people in this world. To be honest with you, I think it's a very crazy concept. It doesn't make sense. But people buy into it. There's white people in the country. Now, when you stop and think about, what does that mean? It really doesn't mean anything other than the fact that the skin color may be different. But it really doesn't tell the story. You know what I'm saying? The story of Irish who came over here, famine, and the story of Eastern Europeans leaving pogroms, the story of, you know, the people from, you know, France and Germany, the whole mess of people that came because they were hungry, because they wanted religious freedom. It doesn't tell the story. It doesn't tell the story of the different peoples that were so-called white are really different peoples and the different languages. And you go to Europe and you see it. You go to Europe and you see I go to Europe all the time. I have a friend that live in 1,000-year-old apartment buildings. Can you imagine? They still have the old timbers from the 1,000 years ago. And it's like, to me, it's like, this is amazing. This is great history. And they still know who they are. And they're not hateful like we are here. You know what I'm saying? Yes, I'm not saying they're not entirely hateful. You bring some Arabs and Africans in there, and all of a sudden they go crazy. But so there is problems. But the other side of it is that they know who they are, basically. You know what I'm saying? Now, we come here, and here's the problem. Everybody says, well, we don't have no roots. You don't have to worry about that. We're building a whole new country, a whole new people. That's a good idea. That's not bad. But I think the balance is that you actually to do both things. You know what I mean? You come in here with roots. You come in here with knowledge, with history. And you also come in with the idea, what can we make new? How can we make it better? Why not have something new? Sometimes traditions, if they're too stifling, can hold you back from ever imagining something else. So, yeah.
I just wanted to add, I was interested in, like, had you earlier wanted to identify and learn more?
Would I be in a gang?
Learn more about your mom's past. Because I think that was a real integral part of...
The thing about gangs is they have a root which has to do with poverty. Rootlessness is one of them. Hopelessness, meaninglessness. Helplessness, powerlessness. When you have those different aspects in your life, you're going to have a gang. If you're feeling powerless, helpless, hopeless, meaningless, you're going to be a good candidate for a gang. And it doesn't really matter what race you are. This has been ongoing. The first gangs, again, going back to the Irish, were Irish immigrants. The first socially urban gangs in New York City were 1820s. They were Irish immigrants. Anybody who's feeling hopeless, rootless, disconnected, all these, that they're going to be in gangs. Now, in East LA, it's the same problem. You got a whole mess of people coming from Mexico, great people, poverty, oppression, the sense that, you know, the police are your enemies, schools don't teach you anything. You're going to have gangs. It's almost like, you know, like somebody once said, if you put a piece of bread and you get the ingredients, right? If you put the right kind of ingredients, you're going to put it in the oven, it comes out like bread, right? Well, you do the same thing with people. If you put in poverty, family trauma, oppression, racism, you put them in the oven, what's going to come out? Pretty messed up person. Doesn't necessarily bring you gang members, but you can have some real angry, rageful people. So it makes sense what happens. If we knew that, then we would know what we would need to do to fill those empties. And to me, culture is one of the ways that those empties, one of the ways, not the only one, one of the ways that a big empty in my life could have been filled if I knew who I was. My mother told me about the Tarahumara Indians growing up. But you know what? She was so embarrassed to be Tarahumara. She was so embarrassed. When I put it in my book, she was angry at me. How dare you tell people we were Tarahumara? Can you imagine? This is our heritage. You don't tell nobody that. It's a secret, she said. She was so embarrassed to be Indian Mexican. So that says a lot about how we are. We're afraid of who we are, and we're hateful to ourselves. And as you know, Mexicans in gangs, just like blacks in gangs, like whites in gangs, who do they kill but themselves? Our own people, our own kind. My biggest enemy, well, I fought white people, I fought Japanese people, I fought African Americans, I fought everybody. But guess who were my worst enemies? My own people, the brown-skinned people. The same Indian, red-skinned, brown-skinned person, they were my enemies. I went after them more than anything. In juvenile hall, I remember if I saw my enemies or if I saw a Mexican I didn't like, I'd jump them. Why? It's a crazy madness that we got fallen into because I had no roots, like you're saying. I didn't know my culture. My barrio was everything for me. That was it. My barrio, that was my culture. That was my roots. I put everything behind the barrio, and I didn't stop and think about that we're all family. That we're all from the same people. I even had cousins in rival neighborhoods that we would shoot at. Family didn't matter. As long as he wasn't in my neighborhood, he was my enemy. Anybody else? Yeah.
My question to you is, here in Southern California, we are a region like built of multi-ethnic backgrounds. Although, where do we start in terms of unification without losing culture, yet still representing our nation like being Americans?
Yeah, that's very good. And that, to me, the question itself is already giving you the answer. Because it really is all those things. I mean, the problem is we only want to do one thing, or the pendulum swing, right? We don't do one thing. If we're not American enough, then we go to the other side, and we're completely not like anybody else, then we go back and forth, and we don't stop and think about the balance. Here's one thing that I saw one day in a building in downtown LA, the Variety Arts Building. There's a great saying. I walked across it, and I saw it, and I've used it ever since then. It says, in unity, in essential things, we find unity. In the non-essential things, we should have liberty. And what that means is this. It doesn't matter what culture you're from. Doesn't matter where you're from. There are essential things that ties all of us up together, right? Somehow, in spite of all our various differences, essential things keeps us united. What are these essential things? Well, food, shelter, clothing, but also spirituality, also the well-being of our children. The well-being of our children alone. Isn't that something that everybody should have? Their children should be taken care of? And it should be taken care of physically, mentally, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually? We want this for all our children. I don't care what race, I don't care what country, I don't care what language. Everybody wants that. Those are the things we should unite around, these essential things. And the non-essential things, like whether you eat hamburgers, mofongo, or tacos, that's up to you. That's non-essential. You should have the liberty to eat whatever you feel like eating, or you know, want to have a head dress, whatever you have. That's the liberty you should have, because what ties us up is our humanity, and those are the threads that we can find that links us up. But the things that we do it the other way around. In this country, we've made the non-essential things essential. People are killing each other over, you know, the people who wear the headdresses. They think they're Muslim. Some of them are sheiks. They're beating them up. Right? You got Mexicans coming over and people can't stand them. They go crazy. They look at my son, my beautiful kids, and they go nuts. We got so many ways that we make it so essential. Is this religion really that more important than that religion? To me, it's important to have spirituality. That's essential. But it's not essential that it be this particular religion. You hear what I'm saying? That to me is when we fall apart and we lose it. You know, you got to go by me. You got to listen by this. You got to do this and scare the heck out of everybody if you don't. I mean, to me, that is destructive, and that is very demoralizing to spirit and to life. And that, to me, is not spirituality. And anybody that does that is not spirituality. And we know what spirituality looks like. We act like we don't. We act like we can listen to these people and say, no, that's spiritual. We know what it looks like. We know what it eats out of you. You know what it takes away from you. You know what it takes your dignity. You know what it takes your very being and your integrity. We should never do anything that takes anybody's dignity away. That's an essential thing. Nobody's dignity. We can argue with people. We can have disagreements. But keep their dignity intact. We can't even do it to our kids. Our own kids, we take their dignity away every day. Our own kids we're stomping. The kids we love, we brought to this world, we treat them like dirt. And then we wonder why they turn out the way they turn out. Kids are born with beauty, with beautiful callings, with beautiful gifts. And by the very end, if they join a gang and they're killing people, we have to look at what we contributed to that. I'm not taking away what their responsibility is, but we have to look at what we contributed. My own son being in jail, it's partly my fault. You know what I'm saying? I was not a good dad. And I know I wasn't a good dad. And I know I abandoned him. And who am I going to turn to? I have to see him in prison. I went to see him 2 Saturdays ago in Chicago. I had to see him in prison. For 9 years I've had to see him in prison. And every time I see him, I try to encourage him. I try to tell him, I love you, son. I try to tell him, I'm never going to abandon you. But inside, I know I messed it up for him. That's the kind of responsibility that people have to speak to now. How we contributed to making kids fall apart and lose it. No kid should be losing it like that. And that we have to look at what we did to contribute to that.
Luis, I agree that we have to love our children, our daughters and sons. We have to tell them we love them. We have to physically embrace them. I think gang injunctions, anything that's implemented to punish our children, are immoral. We should put an injunction on our adults in our society for creating such an oppressive situation for our children.
Sure.
I want to ask you, do you still keep in contact with Ms. Baez and Mr. Perez and Sal and Chente? I mean, myself, I've had many mentors in my life, African-American, Irish mentors, Chicano mentors. I look back where I could have gone wrong. But those mentors, you know, they pulled me by the ears when I was not acting right. And I think they were the people that I mentioned, Ms. Baez and others, were very important. Do you keep in contact with them? And can you talk about them a little bit?
I think this is really important. This is a really important point. I would not be here if it wasn't for those adults who saw something in me that I couldn't see in myself. A real mentor sees somebody for what they really are. They looked at me and they saw trouble, everybody else. They saw a choloed out gang kid, you know. They saw somebody that walking the walk and, you know, trying to scare people. But one or two people saw right through that. They saw right through it. They saw a very lonely, afraid, hungry kid. That's what a good mentor does. And I had one or two people in the book. And by the way, Miss Baez, I haven't been in touch with her. She has another name. I had to change her name. But she is still, she just this year, she retired from being in the schools. She was in the schools when I was going to school, 35 years ago. She just retired this year. And I couldn't be here at her retirement because I was in some other city. I wrote a beautiful letter and they all read it to everybody that was there because she's deserving of that kind of support and love and respect because she gave her life to kids. And Chente is a lawyer in Houston who I have not been in touch with since the book came out. He knows that it's out. His family have contacted me. He personally does not want to contact me, which is fine. I don't want to interfere in his life. He's a lawyer. He's doing his thing, and I'm totally happy that he's fine. For whatever reason, he doesn't want to reach out to me, which is, again, understandable. In other words, I'm not imposing anything, but these are real people who I've cared a lot for, and I will give him credit for what he did. What he's doing now, I can't speak for, but at the time when I needed somebody, he was there, and he was a real mentor. So those are the kind of people, and there's a lot more. I wish I could name them all. I couldn't do it in the book, but there's a lot more that were at the, when you least expect it, especially when you're troubled, there's always somebody there. Sometimes we're so blind to it, we walk away from people who could have saved our lives. We walk away from them. Because we're so into our little world, we forget that they're there. But here's what happens when you do finally make a decision to grow up, and you make a decision to go into the life you were meant to live. When you go into what you should be, all of a sudden, they come out of the woodwork. People who help you when you least didn't know it. And I got mentored at different parts of my life because I made a decision. All of a sudden, I made a corner, and I turned this way, and I went through this door, and guess what? There was people waiting on the other side of the door saying, come on over. We'll help you. People have to learn that. Kids and gangs need to learn that. I used to think that there was no hope, and there was nothing that could change, and whatever I did, nothing mattered, that, you know, it was always going to be this way. That's what I thought. And I have learned in 51 years that that's not the case. And my son being in prison, you would think would be a terrible thing, but it actually has worked out good, because one of the good things about it is me and him have gotten close. And me and him have worked together. And I, unfortunately, have been his teacher and mentor, which really shouldn't be a father. Not that I'm saying that fathers don't have a role. Real teachers and real mentors come from community. Because fathers love their kids too much. You know what I'm saying? I mean, good thing about mentors and teachers, they really don't love the kids that way, which is good. It's good. Because then they can be really harsh to them. They can really tell them what they need to be told. It's really hard when a father's mentoring his kid. But I know, unfortunately, my son has nobody else to turn to. I'm his teacher mentor, and I have to be responsible with that, which means a lot to me. So thank you for that. I know we don't have a lot of time, so let's see if we can get one or two questions. And
I was wondering, do you feel that adolescent literature can help kids learn from falling into mistakes or into trouble that they make?
Oh, absolutely, man. You know, you know what's amazing to me is that kids don't have hardly any books they can relate to. You know what I'm talking about? There's hardly any books with their faces, with their stories. And again, it don't have to be necessarily all Chicano books for Chicano kids, but even a good story about other people that they could find connection with, that's hardly existing in the books. That's hardly existing in the libraries. Now, some people are contributing. Sandra Cisneros contributes. Ana Castillo contributes. There's a lot of people doing it. I'm trying to give my two cents into it. My book has kind of grown like a beautiful, beautiful flower. It's gone beyond even my control. I have no control over it no more. You know, we sold 250,000 copies in 10 years that the book has been out. It's gone over 22 printings. And you know what? It's teachers and kids. Teachers and kids have made that book sell. It's become a bestseller just because of ongoing reading. In the LA County Public Library System, they say it's the number one checked out book in the whole library system. And it's also, by the way, the most stolen book. So, which, again, I think if kids, you know, people say kids don't want to read. You know what? If they find a meaningful book that they can relate to, they will read. They don't want to read the nonsense that people are throwing at them, but they do want to read. And they're not going to find those things. They're going to go somewhere else. If you have meaningful books, they will read them. So I do think they're important, especially in adolescent age, where you can still, their minds are still malleable. That's the one thing people don't realize. You know, when you're talking about the gang injunction, but also trying kids as adults, that's a ridiculous concept. Juveniles and young adolescents are still able to go through a lot of changes. We forget this. Maybe they'll do some terrible, I did some terrible things growing up. But somewhere in my mind, something was able to be shaped, and it was shaped by mentors and teachers and guidance. And I'm not the same person as I was when I was 16 years old. That can happen to anybody. We should never write off any young person. No young person should ever be written off. They're all worth saving. And I feel really bad because I just came to three juvenile facilities in the last month or so. One in Cleveland, though, one of the second oldest juvenile court in the whole country. And then I went to two maximum security prisons for juveniles in Washington State. And I see these kids. And some of them are going to go as adults. They're going to be in, you know, adult sentences. And, you know, they're writing poetry. And they're listening to me. And they come with their poetry to me. And some of these kids are facing 80 years to life. And it's like, you know, they're still kids. They're still, and I don't want to use kids in a bad way. They're still young people able to be shaped and malleable. And they just need somebody to help them, guide them, give them skills, care for them. There's still hope for them. And we cannot write them off. We do worse injustice when we write them off. Yeah.
First, an observation. It strikes me to have you here and be able to share your experience with us, and having grown up mere hours away from here, something had to trigger your imagination. And from the things you've said about it being a best-selling book, apparently language does have an impact. And the fact that kids are stealing the books and that we're all here to listen to you tonight has been because of language. Yeah. And so first, I just wanted to say thank you for being an inspiration through language. And then the question would be is, how else can we reach out as individuals and have an impact on the mass scale?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways to do it. Again, language to me is important. We need to reinvigorate language again. We need to make it trustworthy and honest again. we need to start using language very consciously, very purposeful, and with a lot of poetry. Poetry is natural to us. We don't really have any poetry. Look at our leaders. None of those guys can speak with any, you know, I mean, their language is so bad. You know, like, come on, where are the great thinkers and speakers? And they should be the ones that we call leaders, not these bunch of fools sitting around there willing to go to war and, you know, dead or alive and all this nonsense that they put out there, you know. Language is very important. But I do think the other thing that's also important is, okay, we need to have a language, but we also got to think of causes. People don't have causes anymore. What happened to the great causes? The thing that saved me, besides words and mentoring, is that there was a movement. She talked about being a civil rights activist. In the 60s, there was a Chicano movement. There was a movement. People were in the streets. And I'm going to tell you, there was hardly any gang violence, and I'm sure she'll know because she was going through it, hardly any gang violence during the heyday of the Chicano movement. There was hardly anybody in gang violence. People were active. They were walking out of the schools. They were protesting the Vietnam War. They were trying to build better schools. Everything was going on. And you know what this country does? It went and destroyed all those movements. They got so scared, it went and destroyed the Black Panthers. Most of the Black Panther stuff is not terrorist that everybody thinks it is. Even today you hear these talks. Most of it was beautiful work, mentoring, teaching, having, you know, breakfast programs, helping young people. The Brown Berets did the same thing. I'm not trying to say they were all heroes and they were all great. Some people probably weren't that hot, but that's not the point. The point is that there was movement. There was change. The Young Lords, a Puerto Rican gang that started in Chicago, became a political party, the Young Lords Party. You heard about that? Well, they destroyed them. They started at the same time at the Latin Kings. You all heard about the Latin Kings? Big, huge super gang. They're all over Chicago, the Midwest, Texas, they're in New York City, all over the place. They started at the same time, but the Latin Kings made a decision. They would not be political, they would not be involved in social causes. And guess what? They're existing and they're bigger today than ever before. If you got politically involved, you were destroyed. If you just said, I'm just gonna be a criminal organization, you were kept going. You understand what I'm talking about? I mean, the same thing with the Crips and Bloods. Some of that stuff was very political, but at a certain point, I know because I was in the jails and I saw it happen, some of them decided it wasn't going to be political. It was going to be criminal and everything. And guess what? They became a big thing. And now we got Tookie Williams and they're going to kill the poor guy. Don't let them kill Tookie Williams. I know people are confused about the stories. They don't know about Tookie Williams is the founder of the Crips. Tookie Williams supposedly killed 4 people. And you know what? There's a lot of terrible things that have happened in this world. We don't even know his innocence or guilt because of the fact the trial was very confusing. But that even then, it doesn't matter. We should not have his blood on our hands. Anything that puts that kind of burden on us destroys our souls, I'm telling you. And we shouldn't have it. And let's say he was the worst guy in the world. And as much as I don't like Charles Manson, I was in a jail cell with Charles Manson, or next to him anyway. I don't even think they should ever kill Charles Manson. They should never even kill him. And maybe somebody can say he deserves it. But we should not have that blood in our hands. Tookie Williams should not be killed. And by the way, I wrote a letter to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's on my blog. I have a web blog, and I wrote a big thing on it. And people are protesting, and people are going on there. And now Schwarzenegger has called for a clemency hearing, which to me is a very significant thing. I hope he has the heroic. He hasn't done too many good things. But I hope. I hope that he does one good, decent thing. And that stopped the killing of Tookie Williams. And again, I have to mention these things because, again, people get political, they change their lives, they go after them. There's a lot of people, really heavy-duty gangster people who have killed more people than Tookie Williams could ever do, who will never be in death row and will never be given that kind of problem because they need people like that. So anyway, I mean, I don't know if that helped, but we need causes, real causes. I know it's getting really late, and I want you to sign some books and whatever, but I want to get at least maybe one or two more, and then we'll get going. So you got me, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I kind of stole your book.
You stole my book?
Yeah, my question is, how could an adolescent like myself teach another adolescent? Because I haven't really had any cultural experience or anything, but how could I motivate someone to be more culturally appreciative?
Yeah. Well, I think especially if that's your quest, bring some people along with you. I mean, you're young, so you're probably needing to go through a little bit more, but you know what? Take people with you. I try to do that when I, you know, in the gang, people will say, well, did you get out of the gang? You know, I never left my gang. I'm still in Lomas. People, you know, I'm still there. I never left it. I never jumped out. I never betrayed them. I never ratted on them. The only thing I tried to do was stop the gang warfare, because I got some political, spiritual consciousness in my head, and I realized we were just killing ourselves. And I went back to my neighborhood, and I tried to stop it. We had trucing. I'm sure she knows. Maravilla gangs were trucing. We had trucing from all the neighborhoods that now to this day are killing each other. But we had people trucing, and I was part of that. And guess what? All it took was one or two people who didn't want it, and they shot at me, my own homeboys, to stop the trucing. But the only reason I'm saying to you, I have this quest, and I took a lot of my homeboys with me. Some of them are doing really good, because we went, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just barely left heroin. I barely got, you know, got out of the gang. But guess what? I went back to that neighborhood, and I tried to do trucing, and it didn't work for me. But guess what? Some of those guys are doing okay. I went back. It took me 20 years to go back there, but I went back with Always Winning. And I went back because my homies themselves called me and said, come and help our kids. I had one homeboy who was a heroin addict. His two sons got killed in gang warfare, a 16-year-old and a 21-year-old. His two sons. He quit heroin, and he called me up, help the neighborhood. So what I'm saying is, you're on this quest, stay on the quest. Learn as much as you can. Find good teachers. Find good mentors. But you know what? Bring other people with you. Try to convince as many as you can. In the long run, maybe a lot of people didn't listen to me, but I know I was right to stop gang warfare. It didn't quite work. A lot of gang warfare has continued, but I know I was right. And you know what, who really betrayed the neighborhood? Those guys that kept the warfare going. Some of them aren't even around. They have laid the seed in which thousands have died in this warfare. So stay on that quest and bring as many of your friends as you can. Don't stop learning. One more question and then... Oh, okay. And this will be the last one. I'm sorry.
Are there any plans for you to make Always Running into a movie?
Oh, boy, yeah. Yeah, and, well, I was, but Schwarzenegger is no longer acting, so he was going to have him play me. I know. No, of course we wouldn't do that. Well, I tell you what's really funny, because I am at work actually working on the movie. I have been working on it for a long time. I have kept out of the hands of Hollywood for 10 years. I've had Hollywood come and hit me up, and I've told them to drop dead. Why? Because I just know they'll ruin it. So here's the thing, now I know it has to be done. It seems like now is the time to do it. We just did a play of Always Running in LA. It was at the Ivar Theater. It was very successful. Now a number of Hollywood people have contacted me. I got a Hollywood agent. Now we're trying to do something, but I'm still very adamant that it has to be done right. I don't want this to be a shoot 'em up gang movie. That's not what I want. It's not what it's about. There is a really beautiful story there about a father and a son. There is a story about a kid who was lost who found something. There's that rootedness that I eventually found. There's that story. There's a lot of beautiful stories there, and I want to bring that out. So I'm working right now on the treatment and the screenplay, and hopefully we'll do this. I can't tell you when, because it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of effort, and people say, you know, you're never going to do it independently, but I don't really care. I'd rather do it right than not do it at all. So that's where we're at. Listen, I know we can keep talking, but I just want to thank you. This is really great. Please don't stop the conversation. Keep going. Keep talking. Keep bringing other people. Like I said to her, you're on a quest. Bring other people with you. Come to Tia Chucha's. Share new ideas. And don't ever cave in to these people who are about war and closed-mindedness and all this stuff. Don't cave in to them. Open up your hearts and open up your minds. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Luis Rodriguez speaking at the California State University at Channel Islands on November 29th of 2005. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.